Today at Reader's Corner, Paul Tough, author of How Children Succeed, Grit, Curiosity, and the Hidden Power of Character.
I think a lot of teachers feel instinctively that character strengths matter a great deal in their student success. And I think a lot of them are very frustrated by not having the right kind of tools to help develop those strengths in kids. The reality is we're learning that the sort of tests that we're evaluating students and teachers and whole schools on actually don't necessarily measure the kind of skills that we should be caring about in the long term. So I think if we can pull back a little, let kids have those moments of challenge and let them find their way out of them, we're actually doing them a great favor. We're giving them the opportunity to succeed down the road.
I'm Bob Custra, president of Boise State University. Welcome to Reader's Corner. A child who heads off to kindergarten without knowing his colors or shapes may be considered academically unprepared for school. But what if those measures mattered less and the child's character mattered more? In his book, How Children Succeed, Grit, Curiosity, and the Hidden Power of Character, Paul Tough contends that it's not about how much information we can pack into a child's brain in the first few years or about test scores. The qualities that matter most when it comes to success in life are character traits like determination, curiosity, conscientiousness, and optimism. Today we're featuring an encore edition of our interview with Mr. Tough. His book has been translated into 25 languages, and it spent more than a year on the New York Times hardback and paperback bestseller list. Mr. Tough has worked as a writer and editor for many publications and is a contributor to the public radio program This American Life. He joins us by phone for this interview. Paul Tough, welcome to Reader's Corner.
Thanks. Great to be here.
Well, let's start off with this cognitive hypothesis that seems to govern most of what we know about schooling today and that you're challenging in your book. Tell us about the cognitive hypothesis that most schools operate under.
The cognitive hypothesis is this name that I've given to the conventional wisdom that I think a lot of us share, which is that the one quality that matters most in a child's success is his or her IQ. It's that narrow band of cognitive skills that gets measured on standardized tests. And I think it's why we are so focused as a nation on test scores. We really believe on some deep level that they measure what matters. And what I'm trying to do in this book is reflect the research and the experiments that are going on among a lot of scientists and educators who are challenging that cognitive hypothesis and saying that there are this different set of skills that matter at least as much as IQ and arguably more so.
So let's talk about those non-cognitive skills. I mentioned a few of them in the intro. Help us understand what they are and the role they play in a child's education.
Sure. So they include things like some of the ones you listed, grit and curiosity, perseverance, persistence, self-control, optimism. One of the complicated things about this field is that no one exactly agrees on which skills and traits are most important in this character dimension. So there are a couple of educators who I write about in New York City who have developed a list of the 7 character strengths that they think are most important, and their list includes things like gratitude and zest. There's another educator I read about who talks about resourcefulness and resilience. On the whole, it seems to be this group of psychological or character strengths that help young people and really all people leverage their IQ. So it helps them persist at a task, to focus on what they're doing, and also to have the kind of curiosity and zest that will propel them forward in their education or in anything else they do.
I think you mentioned that personality psychologists oftentimes rank conscientiousness as one of the key traits and self-control as a part of that. Explain the role that self-control plays here.
Sure. So I think part of why researchers focus so much on those strengths is because they're able to study them most carefully. Psychologists have some really good measures of how conscientious or how self-controlled an individual child is. And there have also been some really powerful longitudinal studies that have showed that when children have strong indicators of self-control in childhood, even as young as 3 or 4 years old, that often correlates with positive results in adulthood, everything from how much money you earn, how long you stay in school, to how likely you are to stay married, how likely you are to stay out of debt. Having strong self-control early in life helps with all of those dimensions. The most famous study that indicates how important self-control is the marshmallow study that was done in the 1970s by a psychologist at Stanford named Walter Mischel. And what Michelle did was took 4-year-old kids and gave them this somewhat diabolical test of leaving them in a room with a marshmallow and a bell. And if they rang the bell, the researcher would come in and give them the marshmallow. But if they could wait until the researcher came back in the room, they would get 2 marshmallows. So this was a sort of psychological torture for these kids. But what he found over time was that the longer that kids were able to wait for a marshmallow when they were 4 years old, the longer they were able to persevere at this task and delay gratification, the better they did on their SAT scores, the better they did in college. This one indicator turned out to be a really powerful indication of how well children would do.
You know, it's interesting as I think about this challenge of coming up with these traits and then trying to measure these traits. I'm not a fan of the standardized test. As a matter of fact, we here at Boise State, like all universities and colleges in America, are now dealing with what we call the Nickleby kids, the students who came through high school with no child left behind, and the standardized test, teaching to the test. And they come into college and university work, and they're really not too cool with courses that aren't completely and totally laid out for them the way those high school courses were. So it does seem as though it is easier at this point of the research to measure the outcomes if you're talking about cognitive skills, if you're talking about the information you can pack into a kid's brain, as I said in the intro. So I guess the question I have is, does this present a dilemma for policymakers when it comes to trying to find the metrics to hold schools and teachers accountable for whatever we're going to teach them, whether it's the cognitive skills or the non-cognitive skills? It sure seems like it could be a little tougher to measure some of these things we're talking about now in terms of persistence, self-control, curiosity, and conscientiousness, at least on a test. But I'm maybe all wet. That's why we're talking to you today.
No, I think you're absolutely right. I think it's a huge challenge to the whole notion of accountability. And in fact, reading all this research and writing this book has really changed a lot of my thinking about how we've thought about accountability in this country over the last 10 or 12 years in education. And so I think that there's a lot about this idea of accountability and trying to improve teachers and be able to measure how well teachers are doing that makes a lot of sense. I understand the thinking behind it. But I think the reality is that we're learning that the sort of tests that we're evaluating students and teachers and whole schools on, these standardized tests that measure cognitive skills, actually don't necessarily measure the kind of skills that we should be caring about in the long term. They don't measure how well kids are going to do in terms of, say, their college graduation rates. And this other set of skills that we are now coming to believe matter at least as much, if not more, we don't have good measures for. So I think there's a real tendency, certainly in bureaucracy, but also in social science, to focus on the whatever you can measure, right? But I think it's a tendency that we need to struggle against, because if we learn that the things that are easiest to measure are not necessarily the things that matter the most, to me that doesn't argue to continue to focus on those skills. It says let's try to develop other measures or other ways to assess and choose teachers than just those standardized test scores.
But one of the things you point out in your book here is that there's a whole new application of science to the task of learning coming from different places than just colleges of education. Help us understand what's going on. People, for example, like James Heckman, who you mention in your book.
So Heckman is an economist at the University of Chicago, and in some ways he's sort of the intellectual ringleader behind a lot of this thinking about non-cognitive skills. He coined that phrase and has come to popularize it. And he's the person who pulled together not just economists, but psychologists and neuroscientists to try to understand how these different fields connect and what we know about how children learn and how children succeed. And what he has really pushed toward is this sense that these other traits that are developed by the environment matter a whole lot. And what I think he and the psychologists and the neuroscientists that he's working with are still struggling with is trying to figure out exactly how we nurture these in kids, how we develop them in kids. We know that they matter a whole lot. Heckman, among others, has demonstrated that really persuasively. We know that they're malleable, that they change in kids, and that certain types of interventions seem to be able to develop them better. But we don't yet have one perfectly replicable curriculum that we can take off a shelf and give to a ninth grade teacher or a principal at high school and say, this is all you do, and you're going to be able to increase your self-control and optimism and grit scores in your students. So in that way, I think that it is an encouraging time, but it also, I think, can be a frustrating time for educators who want to just know exactly where to go from here.
So some who are listening might say, oh, right, we're going to hand off child psychology to some economist from the University of Chicago. But then there's Nadine Burke Harris, who's a pediatrician from San Francisco, and you write about her in your book, and she also contributes to this issue of how students learn and the so-called non-cognitive skills.
Yeah, so Nadine was one of the most valuable subjects and sources for me, because when I met her, she was just starting to, so she's a pediatrician who runs a clinic in the most low-income, the poorest neighborhood in San Francisco. And when she got there, she did what you're supposed to do as an inner-city pediatrician. She was improving immunization rates and helping kids with their medicines and with their nutrition. But she couldn't help but feel that there was something that was missing in what she was doing for these kids, that the real problems that they were facing were things that she couldn't immunize them against. It was the violence and the trauma and the chaos and instability often that surrounded them in their homes and in their neighborhoods. And that led her to do a lot of research around the biology of stress. And to me, that's some of the most important science out there, and certainly in terms of what I uncovered in this book. We've known for a long time that stress is important, but we hadn't really understood the way that stress creates long-lasting impacts, that when kids in childhood experience what doctors call toxic stress, frequent and intense stress, and certainly trauma, it doesn't just have short-term effects. It sort of gets under the skin, and it can really last a lifetime. We can see its effects in adult physical health, in mental health, and also in education. We can see it in the development of this set of concentration and attention skills known as executive functions that matter a whole lot in terms of how well kids are able to do in school from the first day of kindergarten all the way through the end of university. And so where I think Nadine is pushing the science and certainly pushing the people that she's working with in San Francisco is to figure out both how to protect kids from this kind of toxic stress by working more intelligently with their families, but also how to remediate it, how to compensate for it if children grow up in those sorts of stressful environments, giving them the sort of support they need to still develop these skills despite those harsh beginnings.
You're listening to Paul Tough. He's the author of How Children Succeed, Grit, Curiosity, and the Hidden Power of Character. So, Paul, we've been talking thus far, and your book spends quite a bit of time doing this, on poverty schools, the relationship between teaching and learning and the problems poverty creates. What's the relationship between what we've learned here and affluence and the problems kids might have in those areas?
So I think a lot of what we are coming to understand about character strengths is relevant to every child. I think the research indicates clearly that skills like conscientiousness and optimism and grit are important for a child's success, no matter what kind of income background they come from. One of the pieces of research that I did was in this reporting in this independent school, this private school in New York, that has actually partnered with a charter school serving low-income kids to try to develop this list of character strengths, this new way of talking about character. And this was some of the first reporting that I'd really done among affluent kids, and I was really struck by the fact that so many of these affluent parents and the teachers and administrators in these private schools are very much concerned about the character of their students, of their kids, and that there is this really strong feeling that the specific stresses of growing up in affluence can cause exactly the same kind of character issues that I think we often see in low-income neighborhoods, that there are very specific stresses often associated with achievement, and that a lot of those affluent kids as well feel a certain emotional distance from their parents. And what the psychologists who now have made a field of studying affluence have discovered is that that particular combination can be particularly toxic for young affluent kids. The reason that I think it's less of a public policy problem is that those kids have lots of resources to fall back on, and the kids who are growing up in poverty don't. But I think it's really striking and important to understand that this is not just a poor kid's problem. This is a problem, I think, that affects kids in all kinds of families from all walks of life, and that every child needs the same sort of character strengths, the same sort of non-cognitive skills in order to succeed.
You know, we throw this word character around in so many ways in a pedestrian fashion. You're focusing here in the book on a slightly more refined or specific definition of character than what we might know, as I said, on the streets. Help us with that.
So character is a challenging word to use, I think, because a lot of us have a lot of associations with that word, character. And in two ways, I think the educators who I'm writing about who are talking about character are defining character differently than many people do. One way is that they're not talking about character strengths as something that is innate and fixed in us. They're talking about these strengths as a set of qualities that develop in response to the environment and that we can do a lot to help kids develop. But the other is that I think a lot of us think of character as reflecting morality and values, that they're all about ethics somehow. And there certainly are those character strengths like honesty and integrity, kindness, inclusion, all of that matters a lot. But the educators who I'm focused on the most are looking at what is sometimes called performance character, these other character strengths that are much more about accomplishing your goals, whatever your goals might be. So that includes things like grit and perseverance, sticking with tasks, finding other solutions, having a passion for a particular goal. And what these educators argue is that it's those skills and strengths that, first of all, matter a whole lot in child success, and second, are more naturally the purview of an educator. We all think that moral character traits are important and that kids need to be surrounded by positive messages at home, at school, in the media, and places of worship. But schools have a particular responsibility to help kids develop the skills that they need to succeed. And what this research is suggesting is that the skills that we used to think were the ones that were important to succeed, the ones that get measured on standardized tests, are not enough alone in isolation. That in order for kids to succeed, they need this second set of skills as well. And that it's an appropriate part of a school's mission to try to help kids develop those.
I do have to wonder, given the fact that so much of this science seems to be coming from neuroscientists and psychologists and economists, what about our teachers and what about our colleges of education? Is this new research being debated in education circles and specifically in colleges of education? Again, I know your book isn't about that, but it strikes me that could be the next step if it's not.
I think it is. I hope it is, certainly. I've really been struck as I've heard the response to this book and traveled around talking to different groups and different people about it, how many teachers and school administrators I've found who really respond positively to this idea. I think a lot of teachers feel instinctively that character strengths matter a great deal in their student success. And I think a lot of them are very frustrated by not having the right kind of tools to help develop those strengths in kids. And I think they often see kids who are great test takers and then go out into the world and run into all kinds of difficulty because they don't have these other character strengths. I think it's an open question whether schools of education specifically are going to take this on. You know, informally, I've certainly heard from some people who are involved in those schools that this is something they want to work on more and want to help teachers find new tools to develop in their students. But I think we're at the beginning of that change. One of the things I think that can be daunting about this research is that it really is about not just adding one or two things to a curriculum or to a school of education. It's really about a shift in mindset toward what skills matter in a child's success. And so I think that can be really daunting for any institution that has to figure out how to wrestle with it.
So you mentioned test taking. What's the ACE score?
So the ACE score is a very, very different kind of test. The ACE study stands for the Adverse Childhood Experience Study, and this was a study done back in the 1990s by a couple of doctors on 18,000 adult patients of the Kaiser Permanente Health Management Organization. And what they did was send out this simple questionnaire to all of these patients, asking them how many of a list of 10 types of traumatic events they had experienced in childhood, everything from neglect, abuse, sexual abuse, physical abuse, to certain types of chaotic indicators in the home, having alcohol or drug abuse in the home, a parent who has mental illness, a parent who is incarcerated. And so they found, first of all, that there was much more prevalence of these adverse experiences, even in an upper middle class population, than they had expected. Many of the people they polled had experienced one or more of these traumatic events in childhood. But then because they were a health management organization and they were able to look at the medical records for all of these 18,000 respondents, they were able to see really powerful and clear correlations between how many of these adverse indicators adults had had in childhood and how their health was in adulthood. And so people who had had significant amounts of trauma in childhood had cancer rates that were twice as high as people who had not experienced that kind of trauma, heart disease rates that were twice as high, emphysema rates that were four times as high, suicide rates that were 12 times as high, all because of experiences that they'd had in childhood.
And you tell us in the book about the neuroscientist Michael Meaney at McGill University, who seems to be operating along the same theme you're talking about here.
Yeah, so Meaney's research, I think, is really important. So he doesn't work all that much with humans. He works mostly with rats, as do many neuroscientists. And what he discovered was there was this one particular behavior that certain mother rats in his lab were doing with their rat babies, known as pups, in the first couple of weeks of their pups' lives. And he called it licking and grooming. So there were some mother rats who, when their pups would get stressed out, would do this soothing ritual. They'd lick and groom their pups, and others would not. And so Meaney and his team of researchers undertook this long study where they looked at what the high licking and grooming, they called them the high LG mother rats, and the low licking and grooming, the low LG mother rats. They looked at how their offspring turned out in adulthood. And there was a clear difference between how well rats did, whether they had been raised by a high LG mother or a low LG mother. The ones who had received a lot of licking and grooming in their childhood were braver, they were more curious, they did better at mazes, they lived longer, they were healthier. And there's a lot of suggestion that there's something similar happening with humans, that when children in the first year or two of life are able to form a close nurturing bond with a parent or another caregiver, what psychologists sometimes call secure attachment, that similarly creates a whole lot of positive effects in children, mostly in this character dimension. And that as they grow up, they're more confident, they're more secure, they're better able to focus, better able to concentrate, better able to get along with their peers and with authority figures. And so there's a real suggestion that those early months of life matter a whole lot, but what matters most is the relationship, the sense of security that kids have, the connection that they have with an adult.
Mm-hmm. You spent a lot of time in schools preparing for this book. Did you come away with any observations that would seem to apply here? In fact, I'm also cognizant of the fact that you're the parent of a young son, Ellington, mm-hmm. and that must be interesting, too. As you're reading about all these things, you have this very young son who you're probably thinking, now let's see, I got to get to work on this stuff.
Yeah, so he was born just as I was starting the research on this book. And so to me, so much of what I was reading early on, especially in his life, I just couldn't separate from my own thinking about him. And in fact, it was Michael Meaney's research on lab rats that I thought about the most, especially in his first few months. I thought a lot about how to be a high licking and grooming human parent. I never actually licked him, and I didn't do all that much grooming either. But I do believe that there's a kind of human equivalent to licking and grooming, and it's about nurturing and soothing, holding children, connecting to them in a close way. Fortunately, I think for a lot of parents, this is stuff that really comes naturally. And I felt really important to understand that in doing that, you know, it's not just about soothing your child in the short term and helping them calm down. You're actually helping them develop in a neurochemical way the kind of strengths and skills and abilities that are going to pay off for them in all sorts of ways, not only in childhood, but in adulthood as well.
You're listening to Paul Tough. He's the author of How Children Succeed, Grit, Curiosity, and the Hidden Power of Character. Well, you were a kid yourself one day, as we all were, and you get very personal in your book. You talk about your experience at Columbia University and the fact that you dropped out at one point. How does that relate to what you found, and what did it tell you about yourself?
So I spent a lot of time reflecting on that. So I dropped out of college twice. I was very persistent as a college dropout and never went on to finish. And you know, I'd always felt a certain amount of regret about that. But when some of my reporting, I was sitting there in high school classrooms with kids, especially on the south side of Chicago, who didn't come from college-going backgrounds, really high-poverty neighborhoods, who were in this program that was helping them get to college and who were very determined to make it all the way through college. And there were lots of moments where I felt ashamed, really, of not having had the same kind of focus, the same kind of far-thinking attitude that they had about my college years. But the other way that I was able to reflect on my college experience was through the thinking of the headmaster at this private school where I did a lot of reporting, the Riverdale Country School. He was a guy named Dominic Randolph. And Dominic talked a lot about failure and about how the affluent students that he was trying to serve in his school, he was very concerned about their character, about the fact that they were so shielded, so protected from real challenge, real adversity by their parents, by their school, really by their whole culture. And as a result, he feared that they weren't learning how to develop these character strengths like grit and self-control. And so in some ways, I think what I did when I dropped out of college was that I was trying to find that failure experience. I was someone who went to a very high-achieving high school, was very much wrapped up in the cognitive hypothesis, I think, as a young person. And when I got to college, it just felt like more of the same. I felt like I was still on that same kind of high-achieving treadmill and that I wasn't really being challenged in any deep way. You know, the work was certainly hard. It took a lot of time, but it wasn't a deep challenge. And so when I dropped out, what I did was I bought a bicycle and a tent, and I bicycled on my own from Atlanta to Halifax. And I think in lots of ways what I was doing was trying to give myself the sort of challenge that I felt like I really needed, the real opportunity to face failure head on. And I think that's something that a lot of young people feel, especially people who are in those more affluent environments. They really need more of a challenge. And if their schools and their educational environments aren't able to give it to them, they sometimes need to turn somewhere else in order to experience that.
So we have time for one last question. If a parent or even a policymaker is listening to you talk about this book and what the science has revealed and what the future holds, given the rap that standardized testing takes to some extent, what do you say about that? I mean, is there still a healthy balance that we can achieve in a school where there's some focus on standardized testing but some focus on these non-cognitive skills, or are you going to throw the standardized test out the window?
No, I definitely don't think they need to be thrown out the window. So I think my message to policymakers and parents would be somewhat different. To policymakers and to school administrators, I think the real message is to find a way to take a more balanced approach to standardized tests. And I know it's hard for any individual principal because there's so much in the school system as a whole that is increasingly emphasizing those test scores and increasingly giving out incentives to teachers and to school systems and to principals based on those standardized test scores. But I think it's important for policymakers at any level or educators at any level to recognize that those scores don't necessarily measure the sort of skills that correlate most with the kind of ultimate success that we really care about, things like college graduation and success beyond that. And so I think that really should push us all toward a more balanced approach where we're looking at test scores, but we're looking at them in the context of lots of other important indicators. To parents, I feel like a lot of the message that I hope this book contains is around the importance of letting failure into young people's lives. And I think especially for kids who are growing up in relative comfort, I really think that there is a lot that many parents are doing to shield their kids, to protect their kids from real adversity, from real failure. And I think in lots of ways, though that comes very naturally to us as parents, I think a lot of parents are coming to realize that in doing that, we're doing as much harm as good. We're not giving kids the opportunity to really struggle with things, to overcome things, to feel independent, to really feel a sense of agency. And it's in those moments that the kind of character strengths that matter so much to a child's ultimate success are built. And so I think if we can pull back a little, let kids have those moments of challenge and let them find their way out of them, we're actually doing them a great favor. We're giving them the opportunity to succeed down the road.
Boy, that last answer there, Paul, hits a nail on the head. That's your next book right there. Why you should allow your children to fail. Every now and then, anyway.
Exactly.
But I get you. That's great. Again, the name of the book, How Children Succeed, Grit, Curiosity, and the Hidden Power of Character by Paul Tough. Paul, thank you so much for joining us today at Reader's Corner.
Thank you. I really enjoyed it.
I hope you enjoyed this encore edition of our interview with Paul Tough. Next week, novelist Jonathan Evason, author of The Revised Fundamentals of Caregiving. The engineer for today's show is Eric Jones, research by Sherry Squires. Our producer is Janelle Brown. I'm Bob Kustra. Please join me next week as we talk to today's leading writers about the ideas and issues that help shape our world at Reader's Corner.